Welcome to Public Historians at Work, a podcast series from the Center for Public History at the University of Houston. I'm Dr. Monica Perales, Associate Professor of History and Director of CPH. In this podcast series, we speak with academics, writers, artists, and community members about what it means to do history and humanities work for and with the public. In our first season, we're examining public history work as it relates to studying the roots of systemic racism in our city, state, and nation. For more resources on these topics, make sure to check us out at uh.edu/class/CPH, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at UHCPHistory. Together, we can help reclaim our past.
For journalist and oral historian Dr. Maggie Rivas Rodriguez, her mission is clear: to record the experiences and contributions of Latinas and Latinos within the United States. As she explains to Dr. Josiah Rector during their conversation on March 2, 2021, for too long have her people been underrepresented within primary sources and scholarship. After noticing this lacuna in histories about World War II especially, Dr. Rivas Rodriguez set out to establish the Voces Oral History Center at UT Austin in 1999. Since then, this project has captured over 1,200 oral histories on themes like political and civic engagement, Vietnam, and now the pandemic. Along the way, Dr. Rivas Rodriguez has learned valuable lessons about the process and technology for recording histories, as well as how to best involve the public in this work. Let's listen in.
Thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
You've had a remarkably accomplished career, both as a journalist and as an oral historian. Could you talk about your career as a journalist and how it influences your work as an oral historian?
So I started off journalism all the way through. My undergraduate degree from UT Austin was in journalism. I went to graduate school at Columbia and got a master's in journalism, got my PhD in journalism. So that's really the foundation of everything I've ever done. When I entered journalism, I was one of the few Latina journalists. I was, for instance, the first Latina hired as a journalist of the Boston Globe in 1979. And as a result of that, you know, being like one of the either the first or one of the very few in a newsroom, it creates a particular consciousness, and it makes you look at what's missing in our news or in our news coverage. So I was always sensitive to that, even before when I was an undergraduate, coming from a small Texas town. I was always very sensitive about issues of race. I'm Latina myself. And so I was very aware that if you open the newspapers, chances are you wouldn't be reading about people like me. And over the years, as my perspective has changed at every level, I've become much more aware of kind of the fundamental structural reasons for all of that. So it's not just that we were underrepresented in newspapers and in television and radio newscasts. It's because we were underrepresented in other ways in educational institutions. And then we're underrepresented in our textbooks for some of the same reasons. So you can look at the same issue and you can see the interconnectedness of all of these issues. So I was a journalist for many, many years. My last job, I covered the U.S.-Mexico border for the Dallas Morning News out of a one-person bureau in El Paso. So from that vantage point, I was covering the entire U.S.-Mexico border. And I was always struck by, I would go out to do a story that seemed like just an ordinary little, you know, economic story. Or at one point, I was even covering a story about high school football, six-man football team in a place called Animas, New Mexico, that was getting ready to break a national record for most wins. So I go to cover this football team, and it turns out that there is a racial sub-story there. So at every point, you know, it's something that's not escapable for me. This is not just because I come to a story with this. It's because I think people in the community would be able to see me and realize that maybe I had an understanding and a perspective that they could share with me. And so they did. And so there was, you know, over and over again, it happened. And so it's just kind of part of my world and part of my makeup. So that's my interest in covering particularly Latino issues. When I went to graduate school, you know, when I was in El Paso, got married, had two children back to back, and didn't want to be a reporter anymore because I wanted to have some stability. I was on the road all the time. So I applied for this wonderful fellowship at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill and got it and went there. So an interesting thing happened there. So I'm at the University of North Carolina and I'm in a journalism program, PhD program, and I'm reading journalism history. So the history of journalism in the United States. And it hits me again. There's maybe a paragraph in a textbook about the contributions of Latino journalists to our country. So it's kind of like you just throw up your hands and say, oh my gosh, this is just, you know, it's never ending. So that was kind of one of the observations. And so that started me thinking why, in particular, what is going on in journalism history that is lacking that perspective? And, you know, my perspective is Latino, but you could say the same thing about Asian Americans, or you could say the same thing about Native Americans in particular. There's very little research. Well, why is that? Well, it comes down to where are the primary sources that they're going to be building on? So as I'm looking through and I'm realizing, okay, there's not those primary sources, it really cements for me one of the great needs is to create the primary sources so that historians and other scholars can go and dig through them and find things within those primary sources, be they oral history interviews or diaries or letters, some nugget that maybe I'm not looking for, but somebody else is going to find. So my friend Todd Moy, who teaches history at the University of North Texas, always says, when I'm doing interviews, I'm interviewing not just for myself, but for the historian 50 years from now. So trying to do kind of a broad scattershot approach to try to look at that. I'm really passionate about these topics. And once I get going, I can talk about this nonstop for about an hour. So please feel free to ask questions along the way.
I love that because there are so many through lines between your work as a journalist and work as an oral historian. And one of those is your, as you said, concern about the underrepresentation of Latinas and Latinos. Clearly, your work as a journalist and as an oral historian has addressed both that issue in both domains. Your work as founder of the Voces Oral History Center in 1999 is a sort of logical culmination of those interests. But could you just say a little bit more about the circumstances that led to the founding of the Voces Oral History Center? Because it's remarkable how much you all have done there. Over 1,300 interviews with Latinas and Latinos on a wide variety of topics from World War II to civil rights activism, and now to the COVID-19 pandemic. How did you end up founding the Voces Oral History Center in 1999? When did it click for you that you would undertake an initiative like this?
In 1992, when I was covering the U.S.-Mexico border, I was doing what we call a takeout. A takeout in journalism is when there's a long running story, once in a while you dip back in and you pull out one piece of it to kind of keep the story alive and also to reconnect with the people that you're interviewing. So I was doing a takeout on another bigger story. And I decided to do a profile of the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, MALDEF. So I proposed it to my editors. They liked the story. And I'm interviewing these people. They say, the lawyers that are part of this big lawsuit I'm covering, and they say, oh, you've got to go interview Pete Tijerina. He's the founder of MALDEF. So Pete Tijerina at the time was a lawyer in downtown San Antonio. So I go to interview Pete Tijerina, and we're talking, and he's telling me about, you know, the early cases and about his involvement in MALDEF. And at the very end, I ask him something, and he says that he's a World War II veteran. And I said, you're a World War II veteran. My father's a World War II veteran. He says, yeah, all of us old civil rights war horses are World War II veterans. And I said, oh my God, that's so fascinating. So I go back, I propose to my editors a magazine piece about World War II Mexican Americans, the contribution of the World War II generation of Mexican Americans to civil rights in Texas. So they love the idea. Well, in journalism, we do the same thing as we do in academia. We try to do the foundational research and literature review. I can't find a book about this topic. I'm finding a couple of paragraphs in a longer book. I'm looking at David Montejano's book, Anglos and Mexican Americans. And, you know, same thing. There's one chapter that he kind of mentions it, but it's not really the full examination of what that generation went through and the contributions that they made. So I interviewed David Montejano, and I interviewed Carlos Vélez Ibáñez, who was at the time at the University of Arizona. And I asked them, where can I find more literature about this period? Because it's fascinating. Everybody that I'm interviewing, every single person I'm interviewing, World War II veteran or civilian, you could write a book about these people. They had such a fascinating story. They grew up during the Depression. World War II hits, and they're in, some of them are in their teens, and they volunteer to go into the military. The women who have been very sheltered end up going to work for defense contractors. Their worldview is just blown. Texas, before World War II, the worldview of a lot of Mexican Americans was that they didn't consider themselves Americans. They called themselves Mexicans, and Anglos were Americans. They put on the uniform, they go to Europe, or they go to the Pacific, and people see the uniform, and they're not looking that their last name is Rodriguez or Sanchez. They're looking at the uniform, and they say, you know, you're an American GI. Their worldview and their view of themselves really change. And for the women, it was the same thing. You know, my mother was one of these women that worked at Kelly Field in San Antonio. And she had dropped out of school when she was in the eighth grade. Super well-read woman. I mean, she spoke perfect English and perfect Spanish. She always thought of herself as not very smart. She goes to work at Kelly Field, and she's working on repairing instrumentation and stuff. And she's really quick. She's really smart, and she catches on. She keeps on getting promoted. And then she looks around and she realizes she's smarter than the Anglo girls. And then she can also speak in Spanish. And there's some things that she can do that non-Spanish speakers can't do. So her idea was that she now sees herself as pretty smart. And that change in her self-image really, really impacts her for the rest of her life. So this was going on throughout Texas and throughout the Southwest, and not just here, it was the Midwest and Latinos all over the place. It's going on for other groups as well, but the group we're talking about and the group that I'm most familiar with are Latinos. So I'm realizing these people, this is an amazing story, and this is much bigger, and there's no research about these people. At that point, there was one book called Among the Valiant, and it was written by a writer named Raul Morin, M-O-R-I-N. And what Raul Morin had done was he had gotten some interviews, and he had also gotten newspaper clippings of World War II, you know, stories about Latinos in World War II and also Korea. And he had compiled them and put together a book called Among the Valiant. That's the only book. It was a good book. It was an important book. But there had not been the kind of deep research on these people. So I knew about oral history at this point. I had learned about oral history when I was a reporter at the Boston Globe and had read Studs Terkel. And I read everything that Studs Terkel wrote. And after I would finish one of his books, I'd say, oh, that's really fascinating. Wow, how could he find so much about the Great Depression? And then I'd say, where were the Latinos? And I'd go back and I'd look for the Latinos. And there were like, you know, there was maybe two Latinos. And that was one of his blind spots, frankly. But I thought we could do the same thing with Latinos. We could create oral history interviews about Latinos. The piece got published in 1993. And I went to a conference of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists and talked to some of my friends there and put together a panel with David Montejano and Carlos Vélez Ibáñez, where we talked about this idea of this history is getting lost and it's really important and we need to do it. So everybody understood immediately why this was important and the steps that we could take. And then life intervened. You know, I got married, started a family, da-da-da. This was 1993. Went to graduate school. And in graduate school, I read Parade Magazine had a piece about Steven Spielberg funding an oral history of survivors of the Holocaust with $1 million. And I remember reading that on a Sunday in North Carolina and thinking, wow, where's our Steven Spielberg? We need a Steven Spielberg. So then when I got here to UT Austin, I had a chance in my first semester, I was asked to take over a class that had a $3,500 stipend attached to it to produce a newspaper. And so I asked my department chair, well, if I found somebody else to publish it for us, to print it for us, can I use that $3,500 for equipment? Now there's lots of equipment available to us. But at the time, we really didn't have access to good tape recorders and good microphones and stuff. So he said, however you can do it. So anyway, I got the local newspaper to switch off publishing our newspaper every semester for the first several years. And it was great. That was important because it created a template for what we could do. My students, I trained them, we did the interviews, and we needed photographs. So from the very beginning, we were producing a newspaper, and that meant that we were scanning photos. And that's really important because now we have interviews with 661 World War II era veterans and civilians. And several of them have photographs. So if you go to our website and you look up our World War II collection, you'll see a lot of amazing, beautiful photographs. So that was really helpful at the beginning that we had the funding available for that. We did the newspaper. The newspaper became our calling card. I would go to an Oral History Association conference or a conference for another Latino organization, and I would pack two suitcases. One suitcase would be full of newspapers and the other one would have my clothes. So that newspaper circulated all over the country. You know, a lot of people started to realize the importance of the World War II generation for Latinos and the role that they played. At that time, this is like 1999, we got a sizable grant from the Belo Foundation, which is attached to the Dallas Morning News, where I worked for several years. So they gave us some money so that we could plan a conference. And with that money, we held a big national conference in Memorial Day weekend of 2000. People came in from all over the country. They came in from California and Oregon, New York, the Midwest. We had people that had research, different pieces of research, either having to do with braceros, having to do with women working in defense plants, so many different aspects of the World War II experience. So we produced one book from that, and then we produced several books now. We have five books that we produced about the World War II Latino experience.
If someone wanted to do a magazine profile on this topic now, they would have rather more than a few lines or paragraphs to work with. So this is an enormous gift to journalists, students, to the public, and really to everybody. It's really remarkable.
Thank you.
When you started the Voces Oral History Center, did you envision that it would last this long or become what it is today? What are some of the surprises that you encountered along the way, in addition to what you've already talked about?
I think the biggest surprise for me has been to do oral history, rigorous oral history. It's a huge investment of resources, time and effort. And skills. And you have to, you know, you really do have to train people. So when we first started, I would travel to Houston, I would travel to, you know, San Antonio, and I would have these, you know, one day workshops where I would teach people how to do an oral history interview, thinking that they could go out and they could do the interviews and then they could submit them to Voices and we could include those. I did not realize how you can't just have it out there. You have to work it. You have to be involved, because most people, the biggest problem they have is the equipment part of it, the technology. So it's just not going to happen that way that you can say, here's how to do it. And these are the pieces of equipment that you need. And you too can do an oral history interview. I did many, many, many of those. And out of all of those interviews, we hardly got any. Out of all those workshops, we hardly got any interviews. But people were interested and they were really committed to the idea of it. So we kind of transitioned from that to doing something that we call a multiple individual interview session. We call it a MIS. When we do a MIS, we pack up enough equipment so that we can do 7 interviews at one sitting. So we have this all worked out so that we can go to any location and we can do 7 interviews in the morning and 7 in the afternoon. And we do a little training thing with interviewers. And now we have it perfected so that no interviewers by him or herself, they're sitting with someone else and preferably somebody who's been trained a little bit more and giving them questions, feeding them questions, you know, on a little piece of paper. That I think is the solution to it, because I think it's asking people way too much to do something that's not in their everyday vocabulary. And frankly, I did a lot of the technology stuff myself when we first started. Some of it ain't pretty. I mean, we have some interviews that the video looks awful because we didn't have somebody. So now I recognize that to do a really good job on these, you have to have the skills of someone who knows what they're doing with the technology.
How has technology changed your practice as an oral historian?
Oh man, I love that topic. To me, the technology is one of the most important factors in training people and also ease of use and accessibility. So when we first started, I went out with that first $3,500. I went out and I bought tape recorders and headphones and microphones and little stands. Because at the time in 1999, 1998, that's what most people were doing. I talked to my friend Hector Galan, who's a documentary film producer here in Austin. And I told Hector what I want to do. And Hector immediately loved the idea. But he said, don't use tape recorders, use video. Because with video, I can then use that as my field research. I can see what somebody looks like on camera and how they express themselves and what they sound like. But I can, you know, it's going to give me a much better idea. So we started off using, you know, we went out then and we bought a bunch of very inexpensive video cameras. Just our first few interviews were only audio. And then we transitioned to Hi8 cameras. And then we went to mini DV cameras. Now what I'm doing is I hire graduate students in radio, television, film, which is a sister department next to journalism. And those graduate students are trained, like seriously trained on the technology of it. So they're able to come in and they use much fancier cameras than we would normally use. And some of our graduate students in journalism too. We have videographers that have come from journalism. So they're able to use, you know, kind of professional grade equipment. So if you look at our video, not from the Voices of a Pandemic, because most of those are on Zoom. But if you look at our video before that, and when we do a MIS, compared to what we started with, it's like night and day. What hasn't changed is the content. I mean, it's really remarkable that in the interview, people really do give them themselves and open themselves up. I've always maintained that as long as you have great audio, you're good. Your video may need a little bit of something and maybe it's not good at all. But great audio, you can always cover it up. If you do a documentary or any kind of video project, you can always cover it up with photographs or some B-roll. But if you don't have great audio, you're sunk.
So the fundamentals are still the same, but so much has been added in addition. That's great. And I also want to say that your website is so user-friendly. So the photos and visuals are a great addition. But as you're saying, the audio is fundamental. Because this is a podcast for the Center for Public History, I want to talk a bit about the relationship between oral history and public history from your perspective. Could you just talk about the reception of your work at the Vose Center with public audiences over the years? Have there been difficult moments? What are some of the most rewarding moments that you've had?
A fundamental part of Voces is that this is, to some extent, a partnership. We wouldn't be able to do what we do if it weren't for people opening up. So we've always, from the very beginning, had public forums. And we always have an open mic moment for every public forum we have. That's one of our trademarks. So it's always been important to me that we give back to the community. And in oral history, it's not cool to pay people to do an interview. There's an ethical, you know, problem with that. But how you pay back is you make sure to keep folks informed about what you're doing and you invite them to show what you're doing. So we do symposia all the time, you know, fairly frequently. We'll step back and we'll say, we're going to share our findings with folks. At our very first conference that we had in 2000, we had World War II vets and civilians come in from all over the country. And it was really illuminating to have scholars sitting there reading their papers in front of an audience of these people that lived that experience and sometimes argued back and said, no, that is not how it happened. It was very, very interesting. That's always been something that's important for us. We try to, as much as possible, let people know where we are in the process. So we maintain good records so that we're able to reach out to people. We create video shorts about different aspects of what we're doing. So last year, we celebrated our 20th anniversary, and we had a big public thing. We don't charge for our events. Most of the people that we interview are, particularly when we first started, these are not people that are wealthy. And so we would never ask them to pay for admission to something. So that's always been an open thing. Bottom line is, our interviews are not to be sitting on a shelf. Our interviews are to be shared and disseminated as widely as possible. So I just got this week, I got a request from a small museum that wants to use some of our photos for a photo exhibit. And I know that they don't have very much money. So we're trying to negotiate how maybe if we submit that we're like a co-sponsor or something like that, maybe we can make some of this available to them without charging an arm and a leg, because we still need to make up the cost of our staff time of doing it. How I look at it is, having the dissemination part of our interviews. We did a newspaper for a long time, and then we did a newsletter. The last newspaper was 114 pages long, and it took me a year to put that together. So then I said, okay, this is taking too long. We need to concentrate on interviews, not on producing a newspaper, really. So actually, we did a book. We did a book called A Legacy Greater Than Words. And that's the reason we did it, is because people would see one newspaper, they'd say, oh, I want to get the past five issues, and we would run out. So I said, we'll compile them, and we'd have summaries of I think it was 425 of our interview subjects. So the newspaper was one part of the public outreach. The next one, then we said, okay, we're going to do a newsletter. And then the same thing happened with the newsletter. So putting together anything that's going to summarize an interview, and you summarize it, and then you copy edit, and we do side by side, it's so much work. It is so much work. And so it just became so expensive, and I had to be doing a lot of the work myself. And, you know, I just can't devote that much time to it anymore. So now what we do is we just have an annual newsletter. We send out one newsletter that says, this is what we're working on, but we don't give a lot of that. So our website is part of our outreach as well. So we're, you know, our goal is to have an entry for every person that we've interviewed. That's where we are. And maybe just a short little paragraph about that person. And then as we get more funding, we can do a longer version that is a transcription and an index. But for that, we need to have explicit permission from the people that we interview so that we can put their interview online. So if we have that, then we can do it.
Just to elaborate a little further on this issue of sort of reception, could you talk about some of the feedback that you have received from community members, both interviewees, but also interested community members, about the work that you do? I'm interested in hearing about the feedback that you've received from those that either participate directly in the interview projects or members of the community who listen to the interviews, watch the interviews. What are some of the benefits of oral history for community members who participate? And what are some of the benefits, of course, for students who work with you as well as faculty?
I believe this down to my toes. I think that one of the beauties of an oral history interview is that people tell you things in an interview oftentimes that they've never said out loud. And they'll say it because nobody's asked them before. Over and over again, we've heard people say, you know, a spouse saying about his wife or vice versa, I did not know that. So I think that it causes people to look at one another in a different way. And over and over again, and I've got to tell you, when we did our 20th anniversary, what we did was we put together little 5-minute short videos about each one of our collections. And one of the people that came in was from Rosenberg, Texas, which is outside of Houston. And he said there was a picture of his wife in the background and with the former mayor of Rosenberg in the foreground. And he said, "Oh my God, that's my neighbor. Oh my God, that's my wife." And I think there's something about seeing themselves and being celebrated that's so important. The Latino community has done important things. Individuals have done amazing work and made amazing contributions, but they have not been oftentimes in our newspapers, or they've been forgotten. I'm going to give you an example. We have this woman named Aida Barrera. I was at Half Price Books one Christmas, and I was looking for something to read during the Christmas break. I come across her book. It's called Looking for Carescolendas. And I said, okay, that's interesting. So I bring it home. I read it. It's an amazing book. It's beautifully written. It's insightful. It's about her growing up in South Texas, coming to UT Austin. She was a journalism major. And she was one of the people who started some of the earliest bilingual children's programs in the country. She had an amazing journey. And I thought, oh my God, that's a great idea. I can focus my oral history class around Carescolendas. Long story short, she was still alive. She was living here in Austin. I reached out to her. And I'm realizing this woman has just kind of slipped under the radar, and people don't even realize how much she has done. So in 2018, we did a tribute to her. We did an oral history interview with her. And the oral history interview that I did, it was, I think it was about 3 hours long. Her story is even more amazing than the book was. She played such an important role, and yet her story would really have been lost. I mean, it's just one example of many examples of all of the rich stories that have yet to be mined, so that we can capture that history and so that it can be included. It's not just a story of Latino history. It's a story, it's a history of bilingual education in our country. It's the history of public broadcasting in our country. It's a history of children's television programming in our country. It slices through all of those different things. That's just one example. So when we were like doing this tribute to her, some of her people that she used to work with, who are children on this program, came in from New York and California and everything. And people that were there who didn't have a contact, who didn't have a background with Carescolendas, I could see them, and I could see that they were looking at her in a very different way. And that's kind of one of the goals, is for us to look at each other in a different way and to recognize the contributions that our people have made. Because if we have young people, and one of the people that was really impressed with her was one of the RTF undergraduate students who was volunteering with us. He was about 20 years old. And he was just like so enamored of this woman that he just was just running after her like a puppy dog and wanting to just soak her up. Our young people have to see people like them represented and understand that our folks have made amazing contributions to our country.
Absolutely. And the work that you do at Voces has been an enormous contribution to that end, clearly. I think this actually forms a pretty good transition to some of the questions I wanted to ask you. You've talked about the issue of overrepresentation and the need for people to see themselves reflected in the way that history is written. And this, of course, includes current history. And here we are in the COVID-19 pandemic, and you're doing this remarkable initiative, Voces of the Pandemic. I read an interview that you did for the Houston Chronicle, or rather you were quoted for an article in the Houston Chronicle, and you said, quote, "Over and over again, what we've seen is that the Latino voice gets not only drowned out, it doesn't even get included to begin with. So we want to make sure that the Latino voice is included and that people can understand in 50 years all the different varieties of experience of Latinos." And you were specifically discussing this in the context of the pandemic and whose stories are being told in media representation, particularly in the context of Texas, where we have this disproportionate mortality and morbidity rate in the Latino community from COVID-19. So could you elaborate on what you said about the need to tell the stories of the pandemic as it's impacting Latinas and Latinos in Texas and more broadly. Why is this crucial at this moment?
Latinos and Latinas are overrepresented. I mean, across the board, you can see it in deaths and hospitalizations in people getting sick with COVID-19. The interviews that we're lacking are the interviews with those essential workers that are the folks that work in grocery stores, the folks that work as janitors, the folks that work as farm workers or meat processing plants. That's been a tough nut for us to crack, frankly. And those are the people that are on the front lines. To cultivate those sources has taken a lot of work, and we're still not there. We still have a long way to go. And that's important because the voices that get reproduced over and over again, it's the stories of people who look like us, who have the same life experience, who are in our social circles. It's other academics or graduate students or people that we, our kids know from something else. It's really important for us, particularly those of us who are in privileged positions, to include the stories of the folks that don't have the options that we have. Those stories are fundamental to telling the story of COVID in our country, and not just of Latinos, but just overall. And they're not really getting included that much.
I commend you for that effort, because I agree with you, it would be a profound distortion to leave those stories out. Now, there's a sense in which you've come full circle, because obviously journalism involves a lot of interviewing people about current events, but you've delved deeply into people's life histories, community histories through your oral history work. And now you're interviewing people about the sort of ongoing set of unfolding events. So I'm wondering if you could reflect a bit on how interviewing people about ongoing events is different from or similar to interviewing people about past events.
Yeah, good question. One big difference is when we do our interviews, they're generally life history interviews. So whether it's a COVID person or, you know, a Vietnam vet or something, it's a life history. So we have kind of a questionnaire, suggested questions, but it has changed. I mean, the entire trajectory of COVID-19 and the interviews that we're getting has changed so drastically. It's amazing. And there are factors that had to be included. There were the Black Lives protests during the summer. That was an important factor. And that created a need to make sure that we get some of those stories told. Then people started with the elections. That's an important story. So we've never had to before tweak our process and tweak our thinking as much as we're doing with this one. Over and over again, something comes to light. You know, somebody asked me, I was on a panel discussion, and someone asked if we were concerned that insurance companies might be unwilling to insure some of the people that we're interviewing who have COVID, or some of the people that our interview subjects mentioned, some, you know, a relative or a friend had COVID and mentions them by name. And I'm like, oh, I really had not given that much thought. We gathered together as the partners and we hashed that out. And we have a system now where we have a post-interview checklist where we ask the interviewers to find out if they do mention some of these things, then we'll just have an excerpt of the interview. We won't post the entire interview online. So over and over again, we've had to adapt. You know, you're on a moving train and this train is moving quickly. So it was the elections. It was the whole issue of masks. Now it's the vaccinations. At every step, and depending on where you are geographically, because our interviews are all over the country, we're having to adapt and really think through issues that we had never had to think through before. So that's one part of it. But the other part of it is, I do think we're working on research now. I mean, there are pieces, there are manuscripts that we're hoping to publish in the journal that we publish once a year. It's the U.S. Latina and Latino Oral History Journal. So that's one part, but the research is ongoing. And I do think that this is going to be a case of, in 5 years, we're going to need to go back and re-interview those people and do a part two and see how COVID has affected those people who contracted COVID, or just their perspective on how has that changed their lives and their thinking about public health and insurance and their responsibility to their neighbors and, you know, all of these different issues. I do think that there's so much material. It is unprecedented what we're going through right now. I would love to, when we first started, I would have loved to have read oral history interviews with people that went through the 1918 pandemic. They may exist. Maybe I didn't try hard enough, but I was not able to find interviews with people that had gone through the pandemic. And I know that they did. There was a, you know, we do have a couple of our World War II vets who talk about seeing the little tiny caskets being, you know, carried out from the pandemic. But that's what I'm hoping for. I'm hoping that we can fully document as much as possible.
The work that you're doing is clearly going to influence the way that the history of the pandemic is written. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the mission of the Voce Center in terms of correcting omissions and distortions. You've talked about the fact that underrepresentation is not only of Latinas or Latinos broadly, but specifically of essential workers, people who don't have the privilege to work at home in the context, obviously, of the pandemic, but also more generally, the ways in which those who were less privileged in terms of class, race, gender, et cetera, are underrepresented. Could you talk more about how oral history can correct omissions and distortions in addition to what we've already talked about? And in particular, the aspects of the Latino experience that you think are most often overlooked, which you see the Voce Center as helping to correct?
It's a pretty tall order, admittedly. And the more I learn, the more I know that I don't know, and the more I realized how much more work there is to do. We have this new thing that we're doing, the Voices Of, that we're doing now. It's an effort to create some of that foundational research. So right before the pandemic hit, on March the 8th, we did a Voices Of Mariachis in San Antonio. We brought together, I guess altogether was 13, 14 mariachis and interviewed them. If you look for research on mariachis, you're not going to find very much. And those interviews were, again, I mean, a slice of American life that just cuts through so many different areas. Before we did that, we did Voices of Documentary Film. Same thing. We brought in 12 documentary filmmakers, interviewed them about their experiences. So that's kind of one of our goals, is to create that body of knowledge so that we are able to look at the pandemic is one thing, but all of these different areas that we can look at. And it's not going to be comprehensive, but it's going to be more than was there already. And it will draw people's attention to topics that hadn't been thought of before. So one of the areas that we're going to look at is animation. One of the challenges is that oftentimes we are invisible in other ways, because being Latino, Latina is not a racial categorization. You could be Latino, and I may not know that. So over and over again, we find that there's these hidden Latinos that change their name because they were told that they should change their name in order to gain acceptance. One of my former students, staff members, is named Vinicio Cinta, and he teaches at Texas A&M San Antonio. And he's the one who wants to do this thing about animation. And so he started doing some research, and he says, did you realize that one of the founders of a studio was Latino? And he had no idea. And the guy's last name, his real name was something like Xochimilco or something like that. But he was told that he had to change it. So over and over again, that's what we see. We see people that they could not be Latino, or they might be Latino. And it's happened over and over again. So that's one of the challenges that we face. So I think one part of it is getting people to kind of come out of the shadows in a different way. We want to be able for our young people to look at these folks and realize you don't have to check your Latinidad at the door in order to be included wherever you go, at the university, in a school, at your workplace. And we see that. We have seen that repeatedly. People who tell us that someone changed their name because they were hard to pronounce over and over again. It's just time. It's time for people to take their Latinidad and embrace it and understand where this comes from and how lucky we are.
You've already talked about this a bit in stating the need for follow-up interviews for the current Voices of a Pandemic project, but what is next for you?
As you know, in oral history, it's not enough to just do the interview, disseminate your findings, you know, have conferences or write books. Those interviews have to be preserved, and that's really important. So I want to make sure that when I retire, there's going to be the same care and the same efforts that go on. So to do that, we need to have an endowment. So that's kind of what's taking up some of my time now, is like figuring out how we can build an endowment so that we can carry on. We do crowdfunding efforts just about, you know, every semester to raise enough money for the next semester. So right now we're getting ready to do one to raise money for the summer. That takes up a lot of energy. So if we had an endowment that would fund us, then we wouldn't have, we could spend money on the actual, I mean, spend our time on the actual work that we're doing. So that's kind of the big thing. But the other part of it is really this Voices Of template that we've developed. I want to do Voices of Animation will be one. I want to do Voices of History Museums will be another one. Voices of Photography might be another one. I mean, we could look at almost any topic, and you will see that the contributions and participations of Latinos from within that has not been well represented. So that's really where we want to spend our time. So I figure we can do one of these Voices Of a year, and we might be able to, if we were, you know, if we got enough funding, we might be able to do two a year. This is not fast work. This is work that really requires to do the research and to put together these pieces. It's something that does require a lot of time. So it's not a quick fix. So that has to continue. And if we want to continue it, we need to be able to have the people that are going to be in place that will do that.
So we've talked already about the Voces of the Pandemic website, which again is really wonderfully user-friendly. And I would strongly encourage our listeners to check it out. Could you remind our listeners where they can find your work and access these interviews?
Yes, if they can go to thevocescenter.org is our main website, vocescenter.org. Or if they want to see just the pandemic work, they can go to vocesofapandemic.org. That's vocesofapandemic.org.
There's also a YouTube channel, right?
Yeah, and we hope that people will subscribe to the YouTube channel. So we do have, if you go to YouTube, you can do a search for Voices Center and you'll find our YouTube channel. And there you'll find the Voices of Pandemic interviews, as well as World War II interviews and a bunch of some of the shorts that I've mentioned, like 5-minute shorts on World War II vets and that kind of thing.
Thank you so much, Maggie, for your time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you all. Take care.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Public Historians at Work. For more about this interview and topics, find us online at uh.edu/class/CPH or on Facebook and Twitter at UHCP History. Remember, we are all keepers of our history.